Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
It was the then Northern Ireland Secretary, Merlin Rees, who christened South Armagh Bandit Country in 1974.
It's been called Bandit Country, and with reason. South Armagh, over the years, has even in Northern Ireland terms, had more than its share of violence and lawlessness.
For some in the area, it was taken as a compliment.
This is regarded as some of the best country for guerrilla tactics anywhere in the world. Perfect country for the undercover men, whether they be of the Irish IRA or the British SAS. Within a few hundred yards of here, you could hide away a whole battalion.
The IRA's South Armagh Brigade was its most effective paramilitary formation.
While army helicopters flew above, a vehicle swiftly passed by. It turned out to be an IRA attack on one of the helicopters.
It took the lives of hundreds of people. British soldiers, RUC officers and civilians.
It was the third helicopter attack in South Armagh in a year, the second hit. In the same period, there were 6 explosions or mortar attacks, 7 ammunition finds and other shootings where one soldier and one policeman were killed.
Journalist Toby Harnden wrote the book Bandit Country, the IRA and South Armagh in 1999.
It felt like this was not in a part of the United Kingdom in any way that I knew it. And so I started to look into this place more and more, and it seems all roads led to South Armagh.
The book has stood the test of time and has now been republished without changes. Toby Harnden joins me now. I bought the book at the time. I read the book at the time. I enjoyed the book at the time. Why did you write it? Why were you inspired to write it?
So, yeah, I was a correspondent for the Daily Telegraph. So I was covering the whole of Ireland, Northern Ireland and the Troubles and the whole island. And, you know, I'd grown up hearing about Robert Nairac disappearing in South Armagh in 1977. And knew all about the Narrowwater Massacre in 1979. And so I'd heard about this sort of mysterious place, South Armagh. So this was in 1996, and I'd arrived in, I think, March of that year, and there was no IRA ceasefire. The IRA ceasefire had been ended in February 96 with bomb at South Quay near Canary Wharf, and I was there at the time because the telegraph office was in Canary Wharf.
At least 100 people have been wounded in a bomb explosion in the East End of London tonight. 8 are now seriously injured, 2 of them police officers. It came as the IRA claimed in Dublin to have called an end to their ceasefire. Police say the blast was at South Quay in an underground garage of a 6-story building.
So, you know, I'm a relatively new arrival. I'm trying to work out how all this fits together. And I specifically remember the day, so early June, I believe June the 7th, 1996. And I'd been in the South covering the shooting of Garda Jerry McCabe. And I was driving north across the border, and there were reports on the radio of huge police and British Army operation in South Armagh connected to the Docklands bomb. So the bomb that I'd been there for in February. So I drove across the border. I remember seeing the sign. It said Fork Hill 7. And I was aware that Fork Hill was in South Armagh. And I thought, well, I'll just turn left and see what's going on. And as I drove in, you know, I could see soldiers in the hedgerows and the ditches by the road, and there were Metropolitan Police officers in forensic suits taking bits of farm machinery out from a farmhouse, and they later established that that's where the Docklands bomb had been mixed and constructed, and there was actually a lorry that was specially modified to carry the explosives. And I just thought, wow, this, I've been transported into a place apart, somewhere completely different. It felt like this was not, you know, part of the United Kingdom in any way that I knew it. And so I started to look into this place more and more, and it seemed all roads led to South Armagh. You had an IRA sniper team. In fact, I believe there was two sniper teams at the time. You had IRA sniper attacks using 50 caliber weapons, often at quite long ranges, killing soldiers and police, and sniper at work signs. You had the England department essentially being run from South Armagh. So the bombs that ended up in England and in Manchester later that month in my home city emanated from South Armagh. And you also had this shadowy figure, Thomas Slab Murphy, the reputed IRA chief of staff, who was running the whole thing. And so I thought, well, where's the book on South Armagh? You know, I want to read it. I want to find out more about it. And there wasn't one. So, you know, fast forward, I thought, well, I'll give it a go and try and write it myself, because this seems like it's an important subject.
Toby, to this day, many journalists don't venture into South Armagh. Many journalists don't know anything about South Armagh. And many journalists wouldn't know how to go about finding out anything about South Armagh. So it does beg the question, how did you go about writing Bandit Country? How did you find stuff out?
So, you know, I was relatively young. I was in my early 30s. I was pretty kind of gung-ho. I was anxious to get stuck in. And in some ways, a little bit of ignorance is not a terrible thing, because sometimes if you know too much and you know, and you kind of go through all the things that could go wrong, you just, you know, don't go through your front door in the morning. And so, I mean, I knew that, you know, journalists weren't being murdered in South Armagh or any other part of Northern Ireland. So it didn't feel like there was a life and or death thing. It was clearly an area that was not controlled by the British state, because you had British Army didn't use road transport or the police. There was helicopters inserting people in that. So the roads were not safe for British forces and the police. But I thought, well, I'll just do the, you know, basic sort of journalism in a way, which is sort of showing up, talking to people, showing an interest. And one of my access points, I guess, was history. It became clear to me very early on that people in South Armagh are very proud of their history of sort of anti-authoritarianism and rebellion. And there was a historical group, there were historical events, there were commemorations, IRA commemorations, where there'll be Sinn Féin councillors there. And, you know, I interviewed Jim McAllister, who was a Sinn Féin councillor, but very much kind of an IRA man, if you like. He was a proud proponent of the IRA and physical force republicanism. So I went to speak to him. And I just sort of built it up from there. I mean, and I also had I developed good security force contacts, particularly in the British Army, but also in the RUC. So I was getting from both sort of sides.
So you did the work, you did the groundwork, you showed up, you were open about what you were doing, and you just tried to get as much information as you could from both Republicans and the security forces. Is it really that simple? You just put the work in?
Well, I think a lot of life is about showing up. And as a journalist, you know, I was relatively new to the profession at that point. But the way I approached it was, if something happened, I went. I mean, Northern Ireland is, and the whole island is a small enough place where you can jump in your car and go. So I was not going to be covering this by listening to Radio Ulster sitting in Belfast. I was going to go, and I was going to talk to people. Now, I was aware that, you know, Robert Nyrat was always in my mind. And I remember there was a fairly senior police officer who I spoke to, who was kind of, to an extent, laughing at me, saying about, you know, you think as a young Englishman, you could just go into this place. And I said, well, you know, I don't see why not. And he said, he gave me a couple of bits of advice. And one was, never try to pretend you're anything you're not. So be upfront. Don't try and skulk in the back of the hall and think you're going to merge into the background, because you won't. Because, you know, like any rural area, but particularly somewhere like South Armagh, people don't pass through. Everybody knows everybody. And they can spot even somebody from, you know, Armagh City a mile away, never mind a British reporter. So I was always very upfront. So I would literally, so I would, if there was a commemoration or an event I was going to, if I knew somebody, say Jim McAllister, Sinn Féin Council, I'd go up to the front, shake his hand, how are you doing, Jim? And then afterwards, I would see people talking to Jim McAllister saying, who's that guy? And you say, oh, he's this strange English guy, that reporter that says he's working on a book about South Armagh. So I was never pretending to be anybody who wasn't. And then the second thing is, I was always aware, this was the other piece of advice, was always have an exit plan. So never feel too comfortable. So if you're there, always be aware it can turn bad very, very quickly. If somebody takes exception to you, or to use an extreme example with the two British Army corporals in 1988, you can see what happens when there's sort of a mob frenzy and you don't have a plan to get out.
Two soldiers have been killed at an IRA funeral in Belfast this morning. They were dragged out of a car, beaten up, and then shot. Today's trouble began after the funeral cortege had left St. Agnes Church in Andersonstown Road. A car was driven towards the mourners at high speed. As it stopped and tried to reverse, it was surrounded by an angry crowd. The two men inside were dragged out and taken into a park. Shots were fired and their bodies were found on waste ground nearby.
So I was always sort of on my toes. I wasn't just blundering around thinking, oh, I'm going to be fine.
You did manage to get an extraordinary amount of information on the IRA in South Armagh. There are an awful lot of people mentioned. There are an awful lot of, for want of a better word, and I use it neutrally, operations described. Were you taking a risk at all there, even after publishing?
I don't really think so. I mean, I knew what these people were capable of. The political situation was such that from, I think, July 97 onwards, it was a ceasefire. It wasn't like the early 70s. It wasn't the Wild West where things were completely uncontrolled.
The picture here in South Armagh is as grim, perhaps even grimmer, than anywhere else in Ulster. Both communities live in fear of those tit-for-tat killings. The army builds up its strength in an effort to deter the gunmen of both sides and to catch the provisional IRA here where they find sanctuary. And the Catholics, who are here in a majority in this part of Ulster, resent largely the army's presence and still give no information about the provisional IRA in this area, which is so close and vital to that lifeline into the Irish Republic.
So I decided that I was going to do everything I could, find out everything I could, write it in the best way I could. Obviously, there were libel laws that I had to be wary of, but I would do everything I can, leave, and then have the book published. And that's what happened. So I left, it was first published in November 99. I left Belfast, went to the, you know, posted to the United States by the Telegraph in September 99. So I felt like I'm just going to put everything on the table, not worry about what happens afterwards because I'm not going to be there. So I didn't ever have to worry about, I could upset this person or that person or be looking over my shoulder because I wasn't going to be there anymore. And that's how it worked out. And I also said to myself, I'm never going to go back. Now, I did go back, actually. I went back in 2014 for just a quick drive around. Well, first of all, the reception from Irish Republicans mostly was very positive, because I think there's a sense that I gave them their due. It was written very neutrally. They had their say. The other side had their say. And it wasn't a book about these terrorists and thugs and psychopaths. And militarily, South Armagh was a pretty accomplished outfit. And in any case, yeah, I know enough about the IRA to know that these are not people who just carry out random acts of violence against people they don't like. So journalists like to big themselves up and sometimes and say, "Oh, I was under threat and I was brave." But I don't think it was really ever much of a physical threat to me.
Toby, I mean, that's one of the things. It was very well reviewed, Bandit Country. I know an awful lot of Republicans bought it and read it and appreciated it. I know that people in the security forces also appreciated it. And I know it was seen as a great and brave piece if, you know, even if you don't say so yourself, of journalism. I just wonder, what impression were you left with of the IRA in South Armagh?
They were a band of very dedicated, very professional people who did what they believed was right. And I think many of them felt that they had not been given their due, which was, I think, one of the reasons why I was able to write the book. And so they wouldn't, obviously, South Armagh Republicans would never have chosen somebody like me to write their story. And I don't think they were casting around for people to write their story, but I was the person who showed up And all of the news coverage was focused on Derry and Belfast and, you know, for want of shorthand, McGuinness and Adams. And I think they felt that there was another side to the Republican story, which was the IRA, not just Sinn Féin, but the IRA and what they had achieved. And it was an, if you compare it to East Tyrone, which was much more heavily infiltrated, many more IRA volunteers killed, they felt, I think, with some justification, that they were successful and they'd been the sort of tip of the spear of the IRA struggle.
So, I mean, that's how the IRA and South Armagh saw themselves. I mean, there were, and there have been, a large number of, let's call it, non-military type killings in the area. You know, whether that's a mistake or someone taking things, you know, going beyond their remit. I mean, how did the IRA explain away things which cannot be justified, even if you are, you know, if you believe in the Republican struggle? That doesn't mean you believe in every last thing that the IRA have ever done. So, I mean, how did they explain the things that just cannot be excused?
So, yes, I did have a lot of conversations about this, and that area of questioning would almost be the farthest reaches of the conversation. So you'd start off with the history and some of, you know, what might be seen within Republicanism as the glorious moments, and then you get to the really difficult stuff. And so what would be covered in that area would be informers. And so this is, you know, very much sort of at the forefront of the news these days, that most informers were interrogated in South Armagh, and if they were judged guilty, would be executed and their bodies dumped on the border. And another area would be some of the sectarian killings. Now, so for instance, the King's Mills massacre, and I read the verdict the other day, clearly, and it's in Bandit Country, that the so-called Republican Action Force was a cover name for the Provisional IRA, and that was a sectarian reprisal killing. So on those two areas, I remember a guy who's identified in the book as Volunteer M talking about informers, and his response was, you know, listen, for God's sake, you know, we're an underground guerrilla army. We don't want to kill people, but we don't have prisons. We don't have the machinery of the state. So it was unfortunate. I'm not proud that we did it, but we did what we had to do. And then on the more sectarian killings, I remember interviewing Peter John Carraher, who is now dead. He's the father of Micheál Carraher, who was convicted of being one of the main IRA snipers, one of the trigger men. And I remember PJ Carraher saying to me about King's Mills, you know, well, there weren't any more killings of Catholics after that, were there? And so it was a pretty bleak, tough sort of outlook. But what he was saying was, we did what we had to do to protect our people. And yes, horrible things happen in war, but we did what we had to do. So I think that's the general sort of feeling. Now, of course, if you're a victim or a relative of a victim or just an ordinary human being who's outside this, you say, well, you know, you can't just use war as an excuse to do whatever you want. And that's what many people who opposed the IRA throughout would say. But that was their justification for it.
I was wondering, could I turn to the military response to you? You know, you mentioned you had an awful lot of contacts in the army. And I was just wondering, I remember the time, the sky was filled with helicopters. I would have thought that every inch of South Armagh was visible from the watchtowers on top of every hill in South Armagh. And this small area was packed with British troops, elite British troops, even special forces, not to mention the RUC. How did the IRA manage to operate in this area at all? Because we really aren't talking about a very large area at all.
Well, I think it was a classic situation where they knew the ground. They'd been farming it and working on it for centuries through their families. And you just have this instinctive knowledge of the land. You know, if the cattle are moving in one direction, then that means something's going on in the area they're moving from. And so maybe there's a British Army team that's sort of dug in there. And although there were all these watchtowers, I spoke to people on both sides about this. There were areas of dead ground, so-called dead ground, where the watchtowers couldn't be seen. And the IRA worked out, again, through their knowledge of the land, exactly where those areas were. So they knew that they could operate with impunity in those areas, and they would use them very, very cleverly. And there were British soldiers patrolling SAS certainly operated in South Armagh, but in relatively small numbers compared to the population. And they couldn't move swiftly because of IEDs and the threat in the 90s of a sniper attack. So they were pretty constrained. And they were also constrained by the law. I remember talking to Colonel Tim Spicer, who is a very, very rich man now through defense contracts. He got the main American contract in Iraq later on. But he was a Scots Guards battalion commander in South Armagh. And he said, we had to operate within the law. We were fighting with one hand behind our back. So they're sort of fighting in a war, but you're having to do it by the sort of Queensbury rules. So there were a lot of advantages that the IRA had against the British, particularly in a place like South Armagh.
The IRA in the area seems to have supported the peace process, not entirely, but it is certainly not a dissident stronghold today in comparison to some areas such as the Craigan Estate in Derry, where dissident Republicans have some sort of strength or presence, but not in South Armagh. Why is that?
Well, I think it's very, very complicated. So, I mean, there were very senior provisionals who opposed the Good Friday Agreement. One of them was Patsy O'Callaghan, who is now dead, and he was named as the undertaker in Bandit Country in the first edition, and still is in the recent edition, but he can now be named. Patsy O'Callaghan, who I think was in his late 60s when he died about 2 or 3 years ago, was really the number two to Vlad Murphy. He had headed up IRA's Northern Command, was an influential figure in the England Department. He was very, very, very senior, respected, visional. And John Crawley, who wrote a good book called The Yank recently, wrote extensively about Patsy O'Callaghan and his military acumen. And he opposed it. So Mickey McKevitt, who also now dead, obviously was the leader of the real IRA, which in this period in the late 90s, he had been the IRA's quartermaster general, and he lived in Dundalk, which essentially in sort of military terms is part of South Armagh. South Armagh Brigade is North Louth and South Armagh. So another very senior figure. Obviously, the Omagh bomb, which was masterminded by McKevitt and involved South Armagh provisionals, former provisionals, or you know, there's kind of a grey area about who's a member of what. So Colin Murphy, who's also now dead, a central figure in the Omagh bomb. But I think they were discredited by what happened with the Omagh bomb, that the carnage it caused, the number of Catholics, including, I think, at least one from a very prominent Republican family. And so I think that undermined them. I think that you mentioned how rich and powerful some of these people got. I think there may have been an element of some people being bought off, and they stuck with the peace process and the provisional leadership, then they'd be looked after, they'd be left to do their own thing. I think some of them recognize political gains. Sinn Féin, the biggest political party on the island of Ireland, which is not nothing. And certainly, you know, at the time of the Good Friday Agreement, we couldn't imagine that Sinn Féin would have replaced the SDLP. So I think it's all those things. And also, I think there were a number of people who just essentially retired and were maybe disillusioned, just thought we did our bit, we gave it our best shot. So I think it's a very, very complicated picture. And it's not as simple as South Armagh back the peace process. But interestingly, you mentioned Derry. Derry, in IRA terms, was completely defeated, completely shut down. I mean, the Derry IRA in the late 90s, when I was reporting, basically didn't exist. So it's kind of interesting that area would be the place where it would be a sort of dissident stronghold. So all this is incredibly complicated.
You have republished the book Unchanged. I suppose that's testimony to that's the book still stands, and that shows an awful lot of confidence, I suppose, that your publishers and yourself have in Bandit Country as a book. But it is unusual to be able to republish a book unchanged. Why now? And why did you decide not to change it?
Well, because I feel it was written at a moment in time, and you know, you can't unscramble an egg and then make it into an omelette. I think it would be a real mess for me to have gone back into the whole thing, added 25 more years of history. That was not the way to go. I do think it stood the test of time. It was a piece of history, even at the time, but it was very, very recent. But we've now had 25 years of perspective since then. I didn't know that the troubles, if you want to use that term, would essentially be over at that point. Like, you can't go and rewrite newspaper articles from 25 years ago. I mean, there's a new preface which updates a lot. Suzanne Breen very kindly wrote a foreword, but I think it has stood the test of time. And, you know, 25 years is a long time, so there's a whole new generation of readers that have maybe heard about the book, but have now got an opportunity to read it and watch for themselves.
Toby, thank you very much.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.